Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:26 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 21st, and it being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, there has certainly been a lot going on this week, and stock markets are really taking it on the chin, and Wall Street was at new reaction lows for just about all the indices in here today. And then, of course, you have all the little questions. There is, for example, the fact that Mattis has resigned as Secretary of Defense for the USA, and that creates even more uncertainty about the direction of policy, or perhaps the brake that had been put on President Trump's policies. So that's certainly something that people are worried about. Then, of course, you had just this week the Federal Reserve basically saying that it does not have the back of the market. And one thing that we've seen in the beginning of the tenure of just about all of the recent Fed chairs, going back to Paul Volcker, has been a test by the market to find out whether there was a Greenspan put, a Bernanke put, a Yellen put, or in fact now a Powell put. And so far there's no evidence of it. So the Federal Reserve said this week that they're going to raise interest rates twice next year, and that they're going to continue on autopilot to reduce the size of the balance sheet. This year they've shaved approximately $400 billion off the size of the balance sheet. This is the biggest withdrawal of liquidity from the US market ever. So, or at least since this index goes back to 95, at least in the last 25 years. Now, next point is that this has only been done once before when we look at the ECB. It was the ECB who took €1 trillion out of circulation, and it took them approximately 2 years. So that was one of the factors that contributed to Mario Draghi saying that he would do anything to support the euro back in 2015. But in order to obviate the significant challenges that the removal of €1 trillion from circulation had on the European economy, they had to add back in €2.6 trillion more. So that was a very significant issue, but the ECB has now also stopped its quantitative easing program. So there is the very important point that back in 2015 there was a very neat handoff from the Federal Reserve to the ECB. The Federal Reserve ended its quantitative easing program and the ECB picked it up. And that passing of the baton, or the mantle for responsibility for providing liquidity to the global market, was pretty seamless, and we continued to see the markets moving higher despite the fact that we had a bit of an interlocution and a ranging and rather volatile period because there was concerns about global growth back in 2015 and 2016. The market pushed on the upside for the simple reason that we were still in a very liquidity-rich environment. Well, the Federal Reserve is now doing what the ECB did back in 2012 and 2014, and it's having a deleterious effect on asset prices. And then the next question is, where is the next source of, and we really have to put an adjective in front of that and say the next big source of liquidity going to come from? Because the ECB, having just ended their quantitative easing program, probably doesn't have the stomach for another round of it. So shortly afterwards, the Federal Reserve has signaled to us this week that they have no intention of moving away from their autopilot in terms of reducing the size of their balance sheet. And in fact, that's not the only thing that they've been doing. They've also created this difference between the Fed funds rate and the interest paid on excess reserves posted at the Fed. And that is an incentive for banks to move their money outside the Fed. But the simple fact of the matter is that that is reducing liquidity available in the market. Because when banks have got free money by posting their reserves at the central bank, it's completely risk-free. when they have to go out into the market and buy something else, then there's an additional source of risk. Even if they're buying the same assets, even if it's treasuries, there is not the same degree of certainty by buying a treasury as you are from getting an interest rate directly from the central bank. Even the fact that they carry the exact same rating, that doesn't matter. There is a different risk profile. And of course, you have counterparty risk when you're posting money against assets. So then that represents a higher risk, and therefore it reduces the ability of banks to extend loans. Well, then of course, we have the fact that we have a yield curve which is very flat. Well, it's at 14 basis points today, and it has at least paused in terms of its contraction over the course of this month, but it's still in a downtrend. And it really would not take an awfully big move for the yield curve to become inverted. Well, when you get an inverted yield curve, it really very clearly signals that banks can't make money by following their traditional business model, which is to borrow short and lend long. So that is putting downward pressure on banks everywhere. And the Federal Reserve removing liquidity from the market is a sharply contractionary event. So this is also putting downward pressure on the markets. Then when we look at the international banking sector, we're presented with a very, very similar set of circumstances. When we look at financially, or excuse me, systemically important financial institutions, SIFIs, globally, they're trending down. And they've been largely range-bound since 2009, but there's a very clear downtrend this year. There has been a very clear loss of momentum for just about everything. We're starting to see an increasing number of downtrends evolving. Completed top formations are just about everywhere. So this is a time where some risk definitely needs to be taken off the table. And then when we look at the contraction in the banking sector, then this is going to persist until we see interest rates starting to come down. But the reality is that if we look historically, it's generally not until after we've seen at least two or three rate hikes, excuse me, rate cuts, that stock markets start to respond. Generally speaking, the first rate cut is recognized by investors as a real sign that the economy is in trouble. So this is, I think, rather important. The other point, of course, is that we tend to look at banks as lead indicators for the economy. The simple fact of the matter is that banks are liquidity providers, and in a bull market, and a bull market, all bull markets thrive on liquidity, banks should do well. The fact that banks are not doing well is bad news. So that is not just a US phenomenon. In fact, the US banks have been the best performers internationally. If we look at European banks, they really don't look good. They look very weak. And there is the realistic possibility that we're going to see additional bankruptcies, which will further thin the constituents of this index. When we look at, for example, Deutsche Bank, then sorry, and you definitely need to type in the correct ticker. Then Deutsche Bank is trending down. It's at new reaction lows. When we look at some of the Swiss banks, then Credit Suisse is also lumped in with Deutsche Bank and is trending down. There are a number of I think it's UBSN is the ticker for UBS. Deutsche Bank, Credit Suisse, UBS, and Barclays were all lumped together in a missive today from US regulators saying that they had not passed or they didn't have sufficient plans in place for upsets, and Barclays as well is now trending down. So that's the case in Europe, where we certainly have a lot of banks that are in rather dire straits because they did not take the steps necessary to write off the debts, or the bad debts, and that those are still sitting on their balance sheets, and they continue to represent a significant weighting. Then Chinese banks broke downwards in here this week. Now, they have had a manufactured uptrend for much of the last 6 months, and that stopped in here this week. Got a number of graphics that are worth highlighting for the Chinese market. The first one here, it's from back in October, but it clearly shows us that the yield on corporate bonds in China is way higher than it is on the emerging markets generally. So that's telling us that if we're thinking about where the risk is in the emerging markets, well, China is very well represented in terms of where the risk resides. Then one of the bigger problems that has been identified by the administration in China has been P2P lending. And that peaked in 2017, but the problem issues within it have really started to crop up in the last few months because of the restrictions on liquidity. This has been one of the most graphic representations of the rise of the shadow banking sector. But when we look at the stock market, well, then it is non-performing loans is what everyone's talking about, but non-performing loans in those state-owned banks has been becoming less of a problem, whereas it's becoming an increasingly large problem in the regional banks. But the regional banks are not listed, so that is something that is sort of back there on in the background of what's going on in China that's not readily observable in the stock market. Well, Chinese liquidity went negative in late 2017, and it remains negative. So these are some of the really big challenges that are outstanding. Well, the Chinese administration have been trying to combat the shadow banking sector for the last couple of years, and they have certainly had at least some success in combating it. So if we're looking for where is the next potential area where we might see massive stimulus starting to come through to support markets, China has got has had enough of a contraction. It's been embarking on tightening up on the monetary and the fiscal side for the last couple of years. It's now at a point where there is the potential for a big stimulus to come through. Well, the global economy needs some form of stimulus to come from somewhere. That we've had a significant contraction in terms of the liquidity situation globally, and that is contributing to this underperformance we're seeing in markets. And we'll certainly look at a number of those markets in a moment. But I think it behooves us to really start to consider what is it that is going to be required to turn this declining sentiment around. One of the things that we've been saying for much of this bull market is that it has been liquidity fueled. The one thing we know about quantitative easing is that it is really useful for inflating asset prices. And the whole rationale for inflating asset prices was in the hope that it would translate into a trickle-down effect and to help to support the wider economy. But that did not happen. Rather, instead, what we saw was a much wider, a bigger gap between the rich and poor, because you did not have the trickle-down effect. And then inflating asset prices put property in particular out of reach for an increasingly large proportion of the population. Now we have quantitative tightening. So because quantitative easing was great for asset prices, not great for the economy, well, quantitative tightening is not great for asset prices. So that's what we're now starting to see, is asset prices are starting to come back down. It's been less apparent yet that it has had a big deleterious effect on the broad economy, but that is really only a matter of time, because when the wealth effect starts to go into reverse, then people feel less wealthy, and the wealthier part of the economy stops spending. And when that happens, then you start to get economic contraction. So This is an important point. But then, of course, you also have the uncertainties that are outstanding in the economy, on top of the fact that the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet and global liquidity conditions are tightening. Well, you have the fact that the Trump tax cuts were initially greeted with enthusiasm, but now we're coming to the point where people are going to have to start paying their taxes, and they're going to get a fright when it comes to April, because so many people have lost so many deductions, and that's particularly true for the high tax and high income states. And it's also true for the leveraged hedge fund sector, because they won't be able to write off the interest on their leverage unless they have been turning a profit, and it's unlikely that a lot of hedge funds have turned a profit, since the majority of them, considering that there are thousands of them, tend to underperform the market, and that's not difficult when they are charging 20% fees. So China is one area where we have the potential for a big fiscal and potentially monetary stimulus. Then when we look at the currency, well, if they stimulate, then that is likely to have an impact on the currency. And the renminbi today was in negative territory, but it has, but not in a particularly dynamic manner. It's been ranging here just stronger than 7 for much of the last 6 months, but this doesn't look like anything other than a consolidation in what is potentially a rather significant bearish environment. If China needs stimulus and it needs a monetary and it also needs a fiscal support network, then it probably also needs a weaker currency. So that's something that we, I think, have to at least pay some due consideration to. Then, of course, Europe also needs a weaker currency. Europe has got some very significant issues, and the two markets that Europe depends on to take its exports, and the exports on which many of the countries in Europe really do depend, are China and the USA. But it's in China and the USA where we have some of the greatest evidence of liquidity tightening, so that's really bad news for Europe. And as long as the euro holds this succession of lower rally highs, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. The reality is that the reduction in the size of the Fed's balance sheet is reducing the quantity of dollars that are available to be lent out, and that creates a supply inelasticity environment, and that's one of the reasons why we continue to see continued strength in the dollar, and every time it weakens, then it starts to rally again. Well, that's particularly then interesting for the bond markets. Treasuries are right at the upper side of their range for the year, and we're pretty steady in here today. The US 10-year Treasury yield has sustained a move below the trend mean, and it really would need to sustain a move back above it to question potential for additional strength here. I've been showing the Merrill Lynch Total Return Index on Treasuries for really quite a long time, and over the course of the last 2 weeks, it has broken out in very emphatic fashion. So this is a very clear indication that people are taking money out of the stock market and putting it in bonds. So the argument about the merits of holding cash have morphed into the merits of jumping back into the bond market. The one strategy that has worked better than anything else over the course of this incredible bull market in bonds over the course of the last almost 40 years has been to buy the dips. And certainly prices dipped, so now they are rallying. Now, that's important because if we have a if the total return on bonds is starting to do better, then that is going to offer a safe haven for stock market investors. Well, the stock market is pulling back in a violent manner. The S&P 500 closed on the low of the week in here today, and this is a very meaningful drop down from that range just below, or mostly below, the trend mean. So We had at least some acceleration. It wasn't a particularly big acceleration for the S&P 500 at the end of last year. Then we had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. That was a really rather significant trend inconsistency. Then the market found support, ranged for a little bit, and then pushed on to new high ground. Then the market failed. Well, you had the failed upside break, and the dynamic of the failure was larger than the dynamic of the breakout, and that brought it right down to test the lower side of the range, and now it has broken down. We're going to need to see a clear countermanding upper dynamic to question that this isn't a completed top formation. So that this is a rather important time here for markets, that we have completed top formations for the S&P 500, for the NASDAQ 100, and for the Dow Jones. The fact is that the Dow, for example, had got the clearest evidence of acceleration, and it has now broken down from that range and done so in a dynamic manner. Well, when we come back and look at this market in a couple of years' time, then it's going to be a very clear example that we definitely had acceleration in the Dow Jones. When we look at, for example, companies like Boeing, which is the largest constituent of the Dow Jones, it clearly accelerated up to its peak in January and then lost momentum. And then we had the failed upside breaks, and now we've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. The volatility of the share has increased substantially, and it's on the cusp of completing a period of right-hand extension or a first step below the top. So this looks like a very bearish pattern. When we look at the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, it completed its first step below the peak in here this week, and it looks like it is going to go lower from here. The Dow Transportation Index has also broken downwards, and this has been a very broad-based decline, where it isn't simply that companies like FedEx are dragging it down, and of course FedEx is dragging it down, but FedEx also did accelerate at the end of 2017. Then it lost momentum, and now it is crashing lower. So this is rapidly pricing in not just a bearish environment, but that there are significant problems internationally. This isn't simply that we're seeing the big declines occurring on Wall Street. It's exactly the same thing when we look at a pan-European index like the stocks. 600, it has been ranging below 400 for the last 18 years, and now it is coming back down towards the lower side of its range. The other point, of course, is that interest rate sensitive sectors have been performing particularly badly, and the Russell 2000 has broken down now. So not only has it broken down, but it is accelerating lower. We definitely have short-term oversold conditions for the majority of these indices, but the reality is that when a market goes from a ranging environment to a trending environment, then overbought and oversold conditions are not reliable. They're the way to look at are the time when an oscillator like a stochastic or an RSI is most useful is when the market is ranging. So, for example, it would have been wonderfully useful in 2014 and 2016, but when you get a massive break of trend, then you're going to get oversold conditions. That is not a necessary condition to suggest that we're imminently going to get a big advance. We may get some steadying, and there's certainly a lot of bad news has been priced in, and we are at a seasonally less liquid time of the year. So there is definitely some punting by quantitative strategies in here to try and pressure the markets lower when they are less liquid. Well, that does hold out the prospect that we could get a rebound in the first week of 2019. But one thing that I think is important to highlight is that if one were to give consideration or to lend credibility to that kind of prognostication, then it would be to ignore the fact that the mid-cap sectors in Germany are it has been underperforming, and this is the largest pullback we've seen. The FTSE 250 in the UK has also pulled back violently, and this is the largest reaction it has posted in the course of its uptrend. When we look at the small caps in Australia, it's a similar story, and they have also broken down in a dynamic manner in, over the course of the last while. The Second Section Index in Japan, having held out for much longer than the other small cap indices, has broken down in a very dynamic manner in here this week. So this is very clearly a completed top formation. So then the if we are going to see support coming through, then what we would need to see is a rally, then a pullback to hold the low, and then a sustained move back above the trend mean. Those are the necessary conditions to question the supply-dominated environment, and right now we haven't got any of them. So this is a completing top formation for a significant number of markets, and we have to treat it like that, that this is a that we give the benefit of the doubt to the downside until proven otherwise. The tightening of liquidity globally is a very meaningful event. The fact that the Federal Reserve has said it does not have the back of the market and is not willing to listen to the signals being provided by the market is a meaningful event. It's the first time we've seen something like that happen in years. And until they change their mind, then we're going to see the resolve of the central bank tested. So this is a meaningful event here. Now, we've talked a little bit about China, but and the potential there that there could be some stimulus coming through, and they did signal that they are going to be more open to cutting taxes and more fiscal largesse in 2019. There is the potential that the USA is going to move towards an infrastructure bill next year, and if President Trump does in fact get the billions he requires for his wall, well, building walls that are several thousand miles long is going to require a lot of infrastructure development. So that's the kind of thing that can produce a stimulus in the form of fiscal spending, and that could be on top of what we're already seeing. So it isn't beyond the bounds of possibility that we do start to see some support coming through. Now, I'm also reminded of the fact that we are entering the third year of the presidential cycle. And generally speaking, in the first half of the third year of the presidential cycle, the stock markets have a significant wobble. Well, I don't think it's correct to say that this is a wobble any longer, that we have definitely seen a very significant breakdown. And it is now for the bulls to prove that we are not seeing that this isn't a completing top formation. So I think then when we look at the potential, what is out there, we need to see willingness that the levers to support the market are in fact being pulled. It's one thing to talk about what the potential solution to the problem is, but that is potentially this is potentially not the right time to be thinking about that. Rather, we need to concentrate on what the actual problem is. And the problem is very clear, that there is a very large liquidity situation that is emerging here, and that when you look at where the epicenters of risk are, well, it's in China and Europe, and particularly Europe. The Europeans don't have the institutional backdrop that, for example, the communist administration in China does, or the USA does. So that is where there could be some significant problems. And there is a realistic possibility that that banks like Deutsche Bank are going to have to be nationalized, or that I really think that the global policymakers have learned their lesson from the Lehman bankruptcy, and that they are not going to let Deutsche Bank and its massive derivatives book become completely insolvent. But it's going to require a significant rescue program from the German government in order to avoid that outcome. So the very simple fact of the matter is that Deutsche Bank doesn't know what it has, and it's going to take years to figure out how all of the derivatives that are sitting on its books are, and the exposures that various banks have to Deutsche Bank is going to unfold. This is also a significant issue. Now, we have the fact that we now know that liquidity is obviously a problem. It's been obvious for a while, and I created this measure of central bank balance sheets a few years ago, and I've been highlighting it really quite regularly. This is the first time that we've seen the total of central bank balance sheets pulling back. And when we look at this year, the measure peaked back at 20.8 trillion in March, and it's currently at 19.6. So we've had $1.2 trillion taken out of circulation over the course of this year since March. The weakness of the dollar, particularly against the yen, has been one of the factors that has seen this measure start to move upwards over the course of the last few weeks, but it's still in a medium-term downtrend. If the dollar were continue to strengthen, then that will have an additional contractionary effect on the global economy. Why is liquidity so important? Well, it's because it's really a very simple answer. Global liquidity has helped to inflate asset prices, and valuations for just about everything have gone up significantly. And buybacks and the corporate bond market have been the primary conduit through which the liquidity that's been created by central banks has found its way into asset prices. So buybacks have been a very significant tailwind for the stock market. And I created these charts earlier on this week. So, for example, if we look at China, the supply of stock, and I figured the supply of stock out by taking the market cap and dividing it by the price so that we get the number of shares outstanding. And it's been trending higher since 2000. Now, if we look at the performance of the stock market in China since 2000, well, here we are at the beginning of 2000, and essentially you've made almost nothing in the market over the course of the last 18 years, because supply has been increasing. Now, when we go and look at, for example, Europe, and this is just a pan-European index. So the Eurostox Europe index is a pan-European index, and the supply of stock has done nothing but go up there too. Well, and we just looked at the Eurostox 600, because it's done nothing but go sideways since 2000. So that's almost a full 18 year range against a background where the supply of stock has soaked up just about any speculative interest. The ASX, that's the FTSE All Share in the UK, has also, is I think, a very good object lesson, because the supply has been relatively steady over the course of the last 20 years. And what that tells us then is that just by going sideways, that has lent some support to the market, because it's been gradually grinding higher over the same period. But it's when we look at a broad index for the USA, like the NYSE Composite, so looking at a very broad index of shares, then we're presented with a very interesting chart, because the supply of shares has been trending down since about 2004, and this has been a very meaningful move. I don't think we can go any further back than that. But when we look at the performance of the NYSE composite over the same period, then since 2004, it has gone up significantly. So that has been a massive support for US markets. The pace with which US corporations have been buying back their shares is completely out of character with what we see everywhere else, and it has been one of the primary reasons behind the continued outperformance of US financial assets relative to everywhere else. That is as plain as day when you look at the supply of shares. And this comes back to the very simple supply and demand argument that you have in every market, whether it is commodities or bonds or currencies or stocks. When the supply of something contracts, the price goes up. And against a background where liquidity has been surging, then not only have you had declining numbers of shares, but you have also had massive quantities of money chasing a limited number of shares. So that has contributed to this very clear outperformance of US financial assets. I think it is also worth looking at just a couple more of these charts, because for example, when we look at Japan and just a broad index like the TOPIX, and I'm pressing the wrong buttons, and sorry, I'm being silent on the mic because I'm not thinking and talking at the same time. Well, we can see, for example, there that the TOPIX has seen the supply of shares continuing to advance over that same period. Then when we look at, for example, the All Ordinaries, the ASX 30 in Australia, well, then, hold on, that's not the, it hasn't taken what I wanted. This is one of the, hold on, that's not at all what I'm looking for. We can see again here that the supply of shares trended higher all the way through to 2009, but it has moderated over the course of the last 8 years. And that has been one of the factors behind the fact that Australian shares have been able to trend higher in a choppy manner over the same period. So these are, I think, very important characteristics, because it gives us a graphic representation of where the supply situation is in terms of this market, and also the fact that it has been, share buybacks have been one of the most important sources of a supply contraction in the market. So tightening liquidity is going to represent a challenge, because what has been the primary funding mechanism for those share buybacks? Well, it's been the issuance of debt. But debt issuance has gone into overdrive over the course of the last few years. That's particularly the case with the US Treasury. They did not take the opportunity to stretch the maturities of the massive amount of debt that they have outstanding. So there is a very substantial quantity of bonds that need to be refinanced next year, even more in 2020, and then a few less in 2021. But as if that wasn't enough, then we also have the same condition in the investment grade and the high yield sectors. But Where this is different is that there was very little in terms of bonds that needed to be refinanced this year. There's over $500 billion worth of bonds in the investment grade sector that need to be refinanced next year. And half of all the investment grade bonds are high yield. Or sorry, that's not, are one step above high yield. So if we see companies like GE and Ford start to be downgraded, and that is a realistic possibility. That GE has been one of the worst performing shares over the last 2 years, and interestingly, it has stabilized over the course of the last few weeks, probably because it's no longer a constituent of the Dow Jones, and anyone who wanted to sell it has probably already sold it. Well, the reality here is that it is being priced as if it has already been downgraded. Ford has been trending down since 2014, and it remains in a consistent downtrend. General Motors has been trending downwards since 2017. Well, that suggests that it's the potential for fallen angels could be one of the factors that could really start to move the liquidity measures. Now, when we start to think about what kind of impact that's going to have on the high yield sector, it's particularly, I think, noteworthy that high yield spreads have broken out, and they broke out in a big way about 3 weeks ago. They closed at 500 basis points and change yesterday, and it's generally speaking when they move above 500 basis points that you start to see stress coming into stock markets. So that's where we are today. It's also what we have in terms of, let me see, I've already pulled up these charts. So this is the high yield spreads, and maybe I've lost them, so I'm going to have to find those again. The high yield spreads for Europe have also been, I'm just going to find them. I've definitely got the Asian ones. That's Asian high yield spreads, but that is from last month. So let's type in that ticker and we'll find that. But the harsh reality is that this is not a this is not a US phenomenon. This is an international phenomenon, and high yield spreads in Asia are currently around 530 basis points. So they have been reasonably steady over the course of the last few months. Then, when we look at the European high yield, it's also around 500 basis points. And this is the chart from approximately 2 months ago. So let me just update that. And the Credit Suisse liquid European high yield spreads have pushed out to about 500 basis points as well. So this tells us that liquidity is starting to dry up. We know that from the condition of the banking sector, and we know it from the condition of the central banks. We also know it from the performance of financial assets everywhere. And it's logical that if quantitative easing is asset price inflationary, then quantitative tightening is asset price deflationary. And we already have evidence of that because that's exactly what happened in Europe. So now we're starting to see this challenge evolving, that there is a huge amount of debt that needs to be refinanced next year in both the corporate and the government sector, and the central banks continue to think that they can raise interest rates into that environment. They don't seem to pay any consideration to the fact that that higher borrowing costs are going to put undue pressure on a significant proportion of the corporate and government sector. But if higher borrowing costs have an impact on the pace of buybacks in the US market, and that is now what is being priced in here, then that outperformance of US assets versus just about everywhere else is going to end. And that's something that we need to pay particular attention to here, that this is a significant issue. So I've certainly been talking over the course of the last few years that it was the trend of buybacks has been the animating force behind the bull market. And now that there is a realistic threat to that pace of buybacks, then this is a significant issue. Generally speaking, it has been the norm in the US market over the last 20 years that companies buy back their shares. But they don't tend to do that. There was a big hiatus in buybacks in 2008 and early 2009 because earnings collapsed. So they don't generally tend to buy back shares in times of liquidity stress. So we're definitely in a point where we have liquidity stress. It is rational that we're not going to see the same quantity of share buybacks. So that's an issue. And on top of that, you have the fact that so many bonds need to be refinanced next year. Then, when we look at the investment grade bond sector, then it's been trending down all of this year. And there is the potential that when you see the weakest members of this index starting to get downgraded, well, they're going to fall out of this index, and that could act as a support. But what it would also do is raise questions about the likelihood of some of the stronger issuers starting to also be downgraded. Well, in any major bull market, there are going to be companies that benefit enormously from the complete absence of due diligence, and that when there is enormous amounts of liquidity floating around, then companies, there are definitely always going to be companies that decide they're going to borrow a ton of money and try and make a go of it before they have to repay it. Well, Netflix is one of those companies, and it is rapidly trending down. There is the very realistic possibility that Netflix is going to run out of money before it reaches profitability. So that's a very significant issue. Then, of course, you have companies like Amazon. Amazon does not buy back its shares, but it has broken downwards in here this week. It has, and if we look at that on a daily basis, it was touch and go whether it would be able to find support in here, and now it has broken downwards. The one strategy that worked better than anything else on Amazon was to buy the dips. And buying the dips is not working. So that is going to contribute to liquidations in terms of the holdings in Amazon. So when we look at the valuation, it's come in from upwards of 200 to 70. So this is still a very aggressive growth multiple, and Amazon is not. Is trading on a price to book of 17 and a price to sale of 3. Well, price to sales of 3 is actually quite modest compared to some of the other companies. So, for example, Align Technologies is trading on a price to sales of 8.6. And when we look at that trend, we have very clear evidence of the acceleration followed by the loss of momentum, the failed downside breaks, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and then a crash. So there has been a very meaningful decline, a 50% decline over the course of just the last 2 to 3 months. Nvidia had been the best performing share in 2016 and 2017, and then it lost momentum, and then you had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and it is still trending down. And there is no evidence yet that this decline is over. But obviously, it's looking a lot more attractive from a valuations perspective at 129 than it was at its peak near 300. So the valuation has improved there. It was in the 20s not so long ago. Well, what this is telling us is that the kinds of companies that have embarked upon massively capital-intensive enterprises are now starting to come under pressure. There is the potential that Tesla could be the one company that went out and borrowed a pile of money that might actually be able to pay it back and or at least meet its financial obligations because it is reaching its production targets finally. But it really does need to hold that $250 area if that is going to be a credible outcome. When we simply look at the FANGs, Apple shares have been prone to a very acute declines. This is by far the fastest one we've seen in a decade. Apple is going to forgo the opportunity to be a leader in 5G, and that means it's not going to be bringing out a new phone until 2020. What that suggests is that at a minimum, we're in another one of these ranges that we saw, for example, between 2012 and early 2014, or between 2015 and the beginning of 2017. That suggests that whenever Apple finds support, it could range for at least 2 years. But I think the more important point now is that it is way overextended on the downside. And there is definitely a panicky environment evolving here. Then Facebook is also trending down, and it probably has more existential threat from regulation than Apple does. Google has been holding around the $1,000 area, but it broke downwards in here today. So this is also a very meaningful move below a key psychological level. But Google has not experienced the same kind of selling pressure that others have. Now, what's particularly interesting within the technology sector is that it's been companies that have got the much stronger dividend profiles that have tended to hold up better. But even Microsoft was pushing to a new low in here today. Cisco was also at a new reaction low in here today. And then when we think about, for example, the companies that have led the way in terms of the adoption of a subscription business model, well, Adobe looks increasingly like that it has completed a top formation. So what that is also suggesting is that the companies that have adopted the subscription business model, that works wonderfully well in an expanding economy, but then people have to start making decisions about what it is that they're willing to hold on to and continue to pay subscriptions for. And that is when you start to see the pressure coming to bear. Well, of course, the underperformance of Amazon is hitting ancillary sectors like Adobe as well. Adobe's continued advance is predicated upon the success of e-commerce, and nothing says e-commerce like Amazon does. So if that's the case, then what is it that is likely to do better if all of these other things are doing worse? Well, there is a rationale that the cloud computing sector should do better, but there's a lot of value that has already been priced into the cloud computing sector, and it is breaking down in an emphatic manner in here this week. But labor-saving devices, such as the cloud computing sector, should do well in a contractionary environment. Now, this is, I think, the important consideration, is that the stock market is pricing in a recession. And the yield curve spread is very tight. But growth figures have not yet turned. Well, that is probably going to be a factor for fundamental investors are going to say, well, valuations have improved a lot, and this looks like an attractive buying opportunity. It is quite normal that when you see a decline, like we've seen, for example, on the S&P 500 or the Nasdaq, that we get periods of ranging. But It is the hallmark of a downtrend that you get a succession of lower rally highs. And that is what we have on the Nasdaq. It's what we have on the S&P 500. It's what we have in Europe. It's what we have in China. And it's now what we also have in Japan. So these are important characteristics. Now, when we think about the big long-term story, well, what is particularly interesting this week is that safe haven assets, even traditional safe haven assets like gold, have steadied up, and gold prices are back above the trend mean. The Japanese yen was also really quite firm in here this week, and that is now right in the region of the trend mean, but it has broken the dollar's uptrend. US treasuries are also stabilizing here, and that continues to look like a meaningful break back above the trend mean. So that's an important consideration, considering that the US Treasury is going to be issuing a shed load of debt next year. That does rather put a limit on just how far these bond prices can in fact rally. And that's perhaps the biggest challenge that we have out there, that the US government is rather inhibited in the amount of money that it can borrow because of the price that it's going to have to pay for that debt. And that's an issue. Well, the escape lever, it would be to devalue the dollar. But considering the stress that we're seeing in the global economy, then what that is contributing to is strength for the dollar. It's not until we start to see much more loose liquidity that you're going to see the dollar starting to come back down again. Then the kinds of assets that should do well in this kind of environment would generally be the utilities and the highly defensive sectors. Well, utilities were down in a dynamic manner in here, but they're still above the trend mean. The number of shares that on the NYSE that are still above the trend mean is contracting rather rapidly. It's now only about 14%. So that tells us that there are a lot of downtrends out there, and there are a lot of shares that have already sold off in an aggressive manner. Well, the index got to a low in 2011, approximately around 10. But the true low was in 2008, when only 2% of companies were above the trend mean. So we've already seen that there has been a very meaningful decline, and there isn't any evidence that it's over yet. But we do know that when you do see these kinds of measures starting to get taken out, where you have such incredibly oversold conditions, then the potential for a bounce starts to improve. So, we are approaching the end of the year. There is definitely a lot of selling going on right now, but that holds out the prospect of a bounce next year. The big test of that bounce will be whether it can sustain a move back above the trend mean, or at the very least put in a higher reaction low. But certainly there are challenges that need to be addressed in terms of global liquidity. We know what the potential solutions are likely to be, and eventually we are probably going to see additional rounds of quantitative easing. If we don't see quantitative easing, then we're probably going to see synchronized global fiscal stimulus. That would solve for the trickle-down effect. And with the rise of populism globally, the trickle-down effect is more important than asset price inflation. So I think that is the thing that we're probably most likely to see. If we're thinking about where the solutions rest, it's probably going to be in a Chinese fiscal stimulus, in an infrastructure bill for the USA, and for Europe in particular to abandon its fiscal straitjacket. That when you've got Italy already doing so, and France flouting budget rules as well, the UK, which may or indeed may not leave the EU next year, and Germany on the cusp of a recession, then the potential here is that Europe could adopt massively fiscal stimulus measures. So that's what we need to see if we're going to stop the rot. But in the meantime, this remains a bearish environment. And when you see these big declines with such commonality globally, then one has to conclude it's a bear market and that it is for the bulls to prove if we're going to turn this thing around soon. I think with that, I will leave you for the week and wish all of you a very happy Christmas. I think it's certainly going to be an interesting week next week. I'm going to take Christmas Eve off, and I'll be back in the saddle on Thursday. So that's the next time that the audio and the comment of the day will be updated. And I'd like to wish again a happy Christmas to everyone.